Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker, do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination. Hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Morning, Big Saxon Jack. I'm Al Rickey on the board. S&P futures up 13. NASDAQ futures up 84 after a bounce back day yesterday after the somewhat non-existent CPI number. I don't know what kind of a joke that is, but is Kevin with us?
I am.
How are you, bud? Yesterday, if you're, I could see you being a Fibonacci sort of dude.
My fib? I don't know about the Nachi part.
Big old long hair, big old beard down to wherever. Kind of thing.
No, never had a beard in my life.
You know, I
never had a beard, never had a mustache.
I did for a week when we were canoeing, but that was it. So yeah, it's not much of a beard for a week, I don't think. But then
yeah, I've just never had the interest in doing it. You know, I tend very much to be low, opt for the lowest maintenance approach.
Yeah, well, now if you had a stash, you'd have to get the stash wax and all that stuff, right?
You got to take care of it. I don't want to take care of it.
No. Anyway, Fibonacci, he was, I'm not so sure why, but he was big on the two-thirds. So a Fibonacci retracement is if market has a move and it comes back like two-thirds. And I don't know why, but he thought two-thirds was like a somewhat of a an odd meaning in all walks of life, and I don't know what I never, there were people on the floor that used to take all his stuff in classes and everything on Fibonacci retracements and everything, and I never did. But anyway, we were down on the like 75 points on Wednesday, and yesterday we were up 50 in the S&P, so that would be a Fibonacci retracement. And what that does, that and a quarter get your phone call if you can find a phone booth, right? Sort of thing.
You can't find a phone booth, and no. I don't know what would they charge for a call nowadays. What do you?
I don't even know. I bet they still have phone booths like in Europe or places. They used to have. Maybe they don't. I don't know.
When's the last time you saw one in the U.S.?
Boy, it's been a long time. They were big dough too. I mean, if you put it this way, 30 years ago, if you and I would have had the 5 phone or 10 phone kiosks at like the Rock Island station here, I don't think we would have had to work. People would fight for those locations because if you call the suburbs, it was not a local call, so it was probably a buck and a half or something. You know, I mean, people were pouring quarters in there all the time. You and I could gleefully spend our day, have a nice breakfast, go out and, you know, pull quarters out of the thing for a couple hours, have a lunch, pull them out some more, and then go play golf. Wouldn't be so bad.
No, not at all.
Our golf game might get better or it might get worse, and we might just get even more frustrated. Who knows? But did you get a... No point in diving into this too much. There's not much to dive into. But the CPI number yesterday, which the market bounced back a lot, all they gave you was the... I've never seen anything like it, Kevin. I'm looking right at the Consumer Price Index. I thought maybe they'd fill something in today. They haven't. They even took the relative importance column out, where it tells you what percentage of the basket everything is. So the only numbers here are November 24 to November 25. Then it has unadjusted percent change. And then it has seasonally adjusted percent change from August to September. September to October is blank. October to November is blank. And the whole index for October is blank. And I thought we ended up paying all these people. Didn't we? I thought we did.
Yeah, whether we paid them yet or not, who knows?
I mean, this is really, really absurd. But I guess if you don't like the numbers, you stop giving them to people or something. That would be somebody's strategy. I don't know if that's what's being used. But anyway, the The Bonds really didn't move on it yesterday, and we're you know, kind of bouncing along here today. So, as we're obviously entering the holiday period. But hey, I don't know if you were checking or they just did this, and for some reason they're doing it again. I don't quite know why. But the CNBC has just popped out here again. There are 70 official college sports valuations 2025, Kevin. 75 top athletic programs. There's a new leader. University of Texas. Yeah. University of Texas at Austin.
That doesn't surprise me. I've seen that before. I've seen them rated that high before. So,
I thought these things were higher.
They have so much money that goes into that program, and they get all the best facilities, and pretty much whatever they want. It's from a sports standpoint, they have, you know, the fan base is very committed to them. So, you know, there's a lot going on. Excuse me, my throat's a little garbled.
The whole world has that problem, it seems, after this weather. But they have CNBC's 75 most valuable athletic programs for 2025 are worth a combined $51 billion. 13% more than the value of the top 75 in last year's rankings. This year's combined programs had aggregate revenue of $11.4 billion, 8% more than last year, blah, blah, blah. So there you have it. But I guess with the K-shaped recovery, as Larissa was talking about on Wednesday, these guys must be in the top part of the K, huh? Just saying.
Yeah, I would guess so, yeah.
But here's the, it's not only interesting, of course, these guys, I don't know how they do they actually have the revenue here. Of course, you've always said that the revenue sometimes is a plug number, but you have University of Texas, valuation 1.48, the 16% more than last year. 2024 revenue 332, year-over-year revenue change up 23%. That seems a little high, doesn't it? I mean, they must have raised their ticket prices, I would guess.
I think it has to do with, you know, success of they're saying the whole athletic department, not just football, right?
Well, but how much is swimming worth?
Oh, swimming's not worth a lot, yeah. But if they're good in basketball, if they're good in baseball, you know, some of those kinds of things. And you got to remember, you know, we know baseball from the Northern School perspective when they really, you know, don't even start playing. You know, they have to play the first month to 6 weeks on the road because there's just not any good weather here. And then even when you get to March and, you know, get to the middle of March and into April, the weather's not necessarily good. So you don't get that same kind of following for baseball at the Northern schools that you would get at the Southern schools. You go down to, you know, a lot of the SEC, even the West Coast. They fill their stadiums. I know Arkansas, as an example, has a berm in the outfield where people go out and throw their blankets. It's like a gigantic party. They fill the seats, but they also fill that whole outfield area, and it's like looking at the infield of the Kentucky Derby or something. And you know, same thing. The ACC schools, your Miami's, Florida's, North Carolina. All those programs, even up to Virginia, they all have a big following. So that would add to the value of your franchise. Not a ton, not nearly as much as football would. But you're not gonna get that same thing out of Notre Dame. And Notre Dame, you're not gonna get the same thing, the same basketball hit, although it's trending in the right direction. So, you know, if they continue to build that and build back to a successful program, that'll give them a little jolt to go along.
With all the travel, and I'm sure you got to start paying coaches, even the best baseball. I mean, what's a ticket? $10? It's not $100, and they don't charge in a park. And
$10 for what?
I mean, what does it cost to go to a Texas A&M baseball game?
Oh, I don't know.
I mean, it's not $100 like football. I mean,
but I agree.
I mean, you know, I wonder what, at the end of the day, how much, I mean, if these things are actual winners.
Also, you're talking about, you know, merchandising, which is huge.
Yeah.
You know, and how many high draft picks do they have? So that, you know, it sort of tells you the quality of the play that they get. That when you look at the draft and where the college players are going, they're, you know, all those high draft picks are from the kinds of schools I just mentioned.
Well, I mean, I would like to see, you know, I'd like to see, I don't really care, I guess, but I would like to see some of the, I mean, even if you have a successful baseball program and you lob the volleyball and swimming program on it, I don't think you're net plus for the three of them, but maybe you are. Anyway, I think
you can be net plus. No, like I said, is it, you know, compared to football? No, it's just additive. That's all.
But is it, you know, even is it compared to the, I mean, we're talking about even the Ohio State, the total revenue of the athletic department is $1.3 billion. I will bet that the budget for the school is $9 billion. So even in these biggest places, it's, but anyway, the Ohio State went down. They think their revenue was down 9% last year. I don't know why that would be.
After winning a national championship, that's interesting.
Yeah. They've got, that's actually a pretty big chunk in revenue with between Texas and Austin and Ohio State. It's $80 million. I'm not so sure I would guess that.
I would want to see the source because, as I mentioned before, a lot of people write these articles, and the first place they go is to the Title IX reporting page.
Yeah.
And that's the one where, the thing that's supposed to be accurate, when you file for the government report, the thing that's supposed to be accurate is your expenses, because they're measuring the expenses for men's programs versus women's programs and how much they spend. When you look at the revenue, some schools take it very seriously and they will, you know, put in real revenue numbers, but there are a bunch that just say, just put in the same number as what our expenses are, and it's just a plug. And then you start saying, okay, what's on book versus off book? How much of the coach's salary is off, you know, is paid by a third party booster group? How much of the how much of the merchandising is included? How much of the how do they allocate, you know, the apparel and shoe company sponsorships? There's a lot of difference from one school to the next, so it really would take a rigorous analysis to really have that right. And maybe what you're looking at, maybe the report you're looking at does have that kind of a good analysis.
I would guess, Kevin, that you and I could
anybody to make sure that what you're seeing is legit.
Well, you're kind of Mr. Rigorous, but I would say if you took it Ohio State, the money they get from the Big Ten Network and national TV, plus the amount of people in the stadium times the average ticket price, gets us 90% of the way there. Throw something in for Ohio State hats and stuff, and I wonder if there's a difference. In Ohio State seats 100,000 people, but there's 50,000 students there. I mean, if all 50 go to the game, there's actually less. They probably pay something, but then they're not paying $100 a throw, I don't think. I wonder if a lot of it has to do with how many students actually go. I mean, you know, the Irish, the place seats 80,000, but there's only, I'd say, 10,000 faculty and students. So you're talking about 70,000 other people that are real paying customers, which I bet is as high as Texas. I bet it's as high as Ohio State, even though the stadiums are bigger.
Yeah, again, John, we'd have to take it apart, and you know, we're.
Well, I mean, they're all pretty even here, though.
As we look at it here.
Well, I mean, the difference between Michigan and Ohio State is $10 billion, or $10 million. So these guys obviously are saying, I have to believe that the Big Ten Network is got to be half the revenue, isn't it, for everybody? I mean,
it's the total TV package. So they're probably, my guess is that they're approaching 50 billion or 50 million, just in media rights for the school, and then it's apportioned amongst several sports, but it's really football that's driving it.
Well, they've got the Irish at 6, and they were 6 last year. They got the revenue up 17%. I mean, their value up 17%. The interesting parts are the people here went up. They got Tennessee going up 16%. Do they have that much better of a team this year? They got them worth. They got the valuation up 19% and the revenue up 16.
They're just up because Carl has taken an interest in them as a Tennessee resident now. He's so entrenched in Tennessee, And you know, now when you get a big shooter like Carl, and interested, then you're bound to go up in value.
Whenever you see this, I always like to see the sort of like.
I'm saying this because Carl's online, and I figured I would bait him into jumping in.
Carl's I resemble that remark.
Yeah, Carl's a big shit. But kind of the step functions are interesting because look at the revenue. Texas is 332. Then the next highest is Texas A&M at 266. And then there's a bunch here. 255, 242, 239. Notre Dame's 235. So whatever, it really evens out in here. So for those guys to be $80 million more, Southern Cal, 242. I didn't think they were going to be that big. Alabama, 235. Nebraska, 221. Penn State. So, like, everybody in the Big Ten here is right about the 220 line plus or minus, Kevin. So you got Oklahoma, 209. Florida, 200. So everybody's kind of in this revenue number. Then all of a sudden you drop. You drop from 200 into the 170s. Then you've got Wisconsin at Oregon's 169, Wisconsin 191, University of Illinois 174. So they're way below, like Ohio State. They must not get anybody there. This guy's $50 million less. And they got to get the same. The TV package has to be the same, isn't it? Or is it? Iowa's 173, Auburn 194. So it's. It kind of works its way down.
It's what they're churning. And just to drive home the point on the other sports, there's something else that may go into the analysis that I would want to consider anyway. And that's, you know, is the success very narrowly focused that some schools have? Or if you have a really well-run athletic department that is good at everything, does that add value to the franchise? And I would argue it probably does, so that when you see some of these programs, that football's driving it, of course, but when you start to say, yeah, but they're really good at everything they do. And this was a point of emphasis in the SEC. This goes back probably 8 to 10 years now, but, you know, when they hired their commissioner, he said, it's ridiculous that, you know, that we're so good at football and we really have nothing going other than Kentucky and basketball. And he said, there's no reason we shouldn't be able to excel at any sport. And you've seen that. You've seen a lot of the SEC teams ascend in terms of their basketball success. And that includes women's basketball.
I was going to say, the girls' basketball has done real well.
Basketball or SEC teams as well.
You know, the other stuff, first of all, you'd rather have people there than not. You'd rather lose less than you would. I just wonder if, when you start chartering planes and everything for your basketball team and stuff, it's hard for me to imagine any kind of big profit there.
Well, it's also hard to imagine, you know, if you look at the Big Ten, when you're talking about chartering and you're talking about travel, they're so geographically dispersed. And the ACC has put itself into that boat, too. They're so geographically dispersed that it's impractical. A lot of the travel that they do is impractical.
Stanford?
That's going to shake out one way or another. It just has to. So we'll see what happens with that. But the SEC is still, you know, even though they go from Texas all the way across to the East Coast, it will say that it's all Southern. It is still largely regionalized and rational in terms of how the travel works for them.
Of course, I guess it doesn't really matter much if you're 3 hours in the plane or four. You know? I mean, certainly not going by bus anymore.
Once you get to five and six, and you have multiple teams, and you know they don't really. I don't even think they intention. I think they intentionally try not to coordinate too much. Wouldn't you think, like for basketball, for example, wouldn't you think that if you're USC and you're traveling to, I don't know, pick a school, you're traveling to Ohio State, wouldn't you schedule the women and the men at Ohio State on the same weekend and double up on the travel? But they don't.
You might want your swimming team and everybody else on the plane.
Well, and anybody else that you can get on there. But they don't. In fact, you know, the teams want to get out of Dodge and get home as soon as their game is over. So, they're not going to wait. They don't want to wait around for the women's game tomorrow.
Gee, they used to take the train and pack a lunch. Now they can't wait 5 minutes. But I feel so bad for them, Kevin.
Yeah, don't you?
Maybe
they don't want the athletes. You know, maybe they're afraid that it'll turn into the Olympics if they if they travel together.
Well, plus, I mean, you talk about whether the costs are all perked up here. I mean, what do you do if Notre Dame decides, the women's softball and they got a decent team? Well, somebody like Carl builds the softball stadium for them. It could have cost $2 million. It's not going to cost $100 million. And all of a sudden, they got a stadium. Now, is that considered free, or is there no implied interest there? There's no anything. I guess not. But it's not really cost accounting either, is it?
No. Interesting question. Because yes, every stadium at Notre Dame, every one of those small stadiums has somebody's name on it.
I'll bet the. Maybe I don't want things to change as much as they're changing, Kevin, or whatever. I'm going to say in 5 years, if we have anybody normal, can we find anybody normal in politics these days? If we had anybody normal, that would be considered income. Why wouldn't it be?
Yeah, why wouldn't it be? And, you start thinking about that. Start thinking about endowed coaching positions.
Yeah.
How do we account for that?
Well, I mean, the coach still has to pay taxes, obviously.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, I'm not talking about for tax purposes. I'm talking about for valuation purposes.
Well, I was talking...
More valuable or less valuable?
Well, guess who I ran into last night? I asked him, Eric May, who's been on the show, and he's had some health issues, but he says he's feeling good, wants to come back on. Eric's a terrific guy. He's still writing. I was giving him no end of grief. Because John Lee just went on a trans-ocean voyage on the Queen Mary II, and it was a literary cruise where they had different authors every night. You could sit and listen to their stuff and buy their books. So, Eric, how the hell aren't you on this cruise? Boy, I don't know. Who do I call? Anyway, but he's a renowned author. And we were talking about how every definition that we thought we knew 25 years ago, I don't even know what the definition is. I mean... Carl and I, and certainly I was kind of roasting a little bit Russell and Larissa maybe 3 weeks ago. If I walked into your classes and I just put on the blackboard showing my age, define profit for me. How the hell would you even do it, Kevin? When you got everything is, this is non-profit, that's not profit. How much does the guy make? He only makes $1 million. How do you make $1 million at a non-profit? What is profit at a utility? You don't care if you pay any dividends. You do a little bit. But then all everybody does is get more money than anybody else. Is that profit or not? What is it? This whole idea of when people talk about we want to be capitalists, we don't like being socialists, we don't like being that. I don't know. I'm not even sure that other than five or six industries, I can even define what we are here. I mean, it's certainly not the old definitions. When you talk about, giving money to a school and the school immediately turns around and uses the asset to make money and sell it to somebody else. What if the Irish turn around and sell all these stadiums, allegedly, by letting somebody in, to a venture capital firm or a firm? Now what does that mean? I just gave money to a corporation?
Well, I think so.
Yeah, I don't even know how you go through any of this stuff. But the first playoff game is tonight? Alabama and Oklahoma?
Playoff game is tonight. Is it Alabama and Oklahoma tonight?
Yeah, where would that be? That's got to be in Oklahoma.
I don't think either one of them is particularly good. They both kind of, their last few weeks sucked. I guess I would probably take more delight in Alabama getting their ass kicked, but I don't know. I don't know what to expect from it. It's interesting that the NFL is going opposite the college playoffs tomorrow. That'll be, we'll see how that does for ratings.
The Bears are on. What? How many? Is just one college game tomorrow, or more?
What's that?
Just one college game tomorrow, or two?
No, I think all the playoff games are tomorrow. Let me pull it up while we're talking.
Looks like it's got to be three more then, right?
Yeah.
Is the NFL just the Bears, or the afternoon too?
I'll pull that up too, but I'm pretty sure that there are NFL games in the afternoon.
Why? We've talked about this before. We don't want to beat it up because we probably should go to break. Nothing's moving too much here. When is the NFL, when or if, are they ever going to decide whether they should be on free TV or not? And Christmas Day, they got three games on. Two you got to pay for and one's free. Don't you think they could have figured it out by now? I mean, last night was on the one of the different things, and I was only able to watch the first half. I'm not paying for whatever it is. Not that I can't afford it. I just don't want five bills coming in for various. It's bad enough paying the cable bill.
If you're an Amazon Prime member, and I don't think you are, but I do believe your significant other is, right?
Yeah.
You just get those games.
Okay.
It's just part of, you know, you may buy it so that, you know, for the shopping purposes, to so that the expedited delivery and no extra charge is built into the membership fee. But you get all the Amazon Prime video access and streaming and so on.
But the games from Europe weren't Amazon. They were something else, right?
The Eagles. We have the Eagles at 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock Central tomorrow, 5 o'clock Eastern. Eagles against the Commanders, and then at 8:20, you have the Packers and Bears. For the college schedule, at noon you get Miami and Texas A&M. At 3:30, you get Tulane and Ole Miss, and at 7:30, you get James Madison and Oregon. I am sure the Bears and those are all Eastern times that I'm looking at. I'm sure that when that night game, as soon as the Bears Packers starts, they will siphon off the audience from James Madison and Oregon.
I would say so. What I mean, it has to be relatively simple. I mean, if you compare Thursday night to Monday night and Sunday night, what do you suppose? Well, actually, it's three good comparisons. You've got free TV, over the air TV, and Sunday night. You got ESPN, which I think virtually everybody has, on Monday night. And then you've got something where less people have. If you and I were, you know, we're going to make a commercial for Ivy Tech or PTI Securities, I'm sure as hell not going to pay the same number on Thursday night as I'm going to pay on Sunday, am I? What do you suppose the discount is?
Couldn't begin to guess, Tom.
I suppose, I bet we could find the ratings. The amount of people watching on Thursday versus Monday, or maybe they don't put those out either.
Of course you can. How many people are watching, you know, how many people are watching streams versus how many people are watching the, you know, the various over the airs. And you're right. You can check the various evening rankings and so on. It's all there. It's all there for anybody willing to do the work. I personally don't care. Other than, you know, for access to watching the games. If I like to watch the games, then it matters how easy it is for me to do it. And like you said, I'm not going to go subscribe to all that many streaming services. I think the Major League Baseball is worse than any of them.
Oh, yeah. Especially if you get the Major League Baseball package, which is supposed to give you every game, and it doesn't.
Yeah.
They sell the same game, what, five times?
And you know what? You can talk about how much they get paid to do it, but there's also the cost of pissing off your customers.
Well, I mean, the thing about, to be honest, I think neither one of us really care how much money those guys make, but because they're making enough. The NFL has to have been doing this now for 20 years. The original Thursday night game was on the NFL Network. Then that was a bomb. Then they put it on free TV for a while. Then they tried some other streaming or whatever it was. And you would think that after 20 years of basically farting around with this, that they would have a clear number that, okay, if we get paid by Amazon to put it there, we make $3 million from Amazon or $5 million from Amazon, but we take a $1 million or $12 million commercial hit because less people. You would think the numbers would have piled up by now to where they would have a clear, you know, a kind of a clear understanding, but it doesn't appear that they do, does it?
Well, I don't know that that's entirely true. I don't think, you know, I think when it comes to, to managing the revenue, the NFL is really good at it, so they probably do know exactly. The question is their strategy short-sighted or not? You know, that's a different question.
Well, it also could be that the Amazons of the world have so much money that they overpay.
And that's what I mean. Yeah. Is that, you know, so the NFL knows how much they're getting paid, and they know if that's if it's a profitable deal or not. I think they have a pretty good idea of that. What I don't think they're looking at is what's this going to do to my fan base 10 years down the road? And it may not be a problem. It may be that people are so used to streaming services and so many people are Amazon Prime members that they're not killing a market. But I do think you find a lot, some of the other sports, and baseball would be one of them, where, you know, they're starting to shut out a lot of young, you know, their next generation of fans, basically. And you don't want to do that.
Well, that's true. I mean, aren't they, but the games from Europe, they were on Apple, weren't they?
NFL? Football games from Europe? No, they were on the NFL Network.
Which is who? Which is the NFL?
It's the NFL, yeah. It's the NFL's own production.
I thought they sold pieces of that to somebody, ESPN, you know, or something.
That's in my cable package. That's in my.
All right, because it's not in mine. Well, that's all right. So what? The rest of the year, Kevin. You know, not in terms of specifically where the market goes. We now have a lot of data that, whatever, you can't. I don't know if you can believe it or whatever. You don't know, or you're just not getting it. You know, Carl was going through the labor numbers the other day, and they're a little. You know, I don't know about. They're not normal. Let's put it that way. CPI numbers look like they're not. They don't exist. How much do they even matter? I mean, is it now we have a whole bunch of other people making their estimates, or you know, what are we doing here? I guess is the question.
That's why on Wednesday when I brought up the ISM numbers, because I think that's, you know, that's the industry telling you what's going on, and as I mentioned, it's sort of all over the place. I don't know what to, you know, that there's a lot of contradictions in terms of what the activity is doing, and so I'm not sure how it's going to shake out. But I do think that that's more indicative. I don't think you can take any of the government numbers that have been released and say, well, okay, there's a story it's telling me. I see where it's going. But when you see a jumble that's saying, you know, we're seeing, you know, inventories piling up at the customer sites, inventories falling here. Well, that would indicate a slowdown is on the way. On the other hand, you know, you just have this whole mix of activity, and you know, I don't know what you make of it.
Well, the number that appears to be creeping is the in absolutely the wrong direction is the percentage of the people that seem to be working, and whether or not the unemployment rate did jump from 4.4 to 4.6, but that means people looking for a job. Actually, had some buffoon on CNBC talking about how positive that is for the economy because people are now looking for a job, and that's I think that the way they do this now, Kevin. It, you know, it used to be, yeah, it's been so long. When I got laid off at Pullman, when everybody got fired, you know, you had to tell people you were looking for a job, and I think even after, they also did some study, I mean, I don't know, this is a long time ago, but they did some studies on people who were looking for a job even though maybe your checks ran out. Now I think as soon as your unemployment checks run out, they don't put you in the unemployed column, they put you in the we don't know what you're doing column. I think they cheat, and if they're not sending you a check, where allegedly you got to go online or go there and tell them who you interviewed and all other stuff, they shortcut it and just say you're off. So for that unemployment, people unemployed to bulge, I don't think they count people that come off the sofa and all of a sudden start to look for a job. I don't see how they could. So the only way that number could go up, and maybe even Carl's on, he'll debate it, when the only way that number could go up is people just got laid off that are actually getting a check. Or where do you think I'm wrong here?
So I think the real question out of all the numbers is, you know, what you're tracking. What makes somebody employable at the end of 2025? Is that different than end of 2024, 23, et cetera? Because there is a, you know, an ever-increasing amount of technology content, even in jobs like working at Walmart and so on. And, you know, how many people are hopelessly terrible at it because of our education system in so many areas sucks. And so we're churning out people out of high school who are not particularly employable, you know, with their skill set. And, you know, I think that's, you know, that's another factor that's going on. I mean, you know, what do you see if you go into Meijer? How many people do you see going up and down the aisles just picking orders?
Six in the morning, not too many.
Okay, but if you go in the afternoon, you'll see a lot. And, you know, so can you operate the handheld? Do you know what it's telling you? You know, do you follow the routing instructions? This is not genius material, but we crank out a lot of people who are just totally hopeless at it. They're really good at watching TikTok videos, but that's about it.
Well, there's a lot of people that I wouldn't exactly call overly educated that sure as hell can do a lot on a cell phone more than I can.
Yeah, as I said, people are good with cell phones. And, you know, and I go back to a long time ago, this is sort of pre the cell phone explosion. Are people designing their systems to around what the capabilities of the workforce are? And, you know, I don't know about that. There was a time when I was reading about Taco Bell. You know, they hire... you know, so many high school kids that they were building their in-store systems to be to look a lot like video games. Are they really doing gamification now? I don't know. You know, that's a good question. But you know, if you do a lot of game stuff, you know, make all of your in-store systems start to look like video games, then all of a sudden you have this whole generation of people that are adaptable to it. I don't know if they have that or not. I know in manufacturing, it's not that way, and it's not going to be that way anytime soon. So
I think didn't McDonald's start out with a picture of the Egg McMuffin on the key? I could do that.
Start getting into that, but that, you know, that's the kind of stuff that's going to show up in services. You know, I'm much more interested in, you know, for the health of the economy and the manufacturing base. And, you know, are we doing it there? Are we churning out people who are really employable to do anything other than grunt work in an old-style, dirty factory? And because factories are changing so much and have changed so much over the years, you know, are we turning out people who are employable in that environment?
Well, the place you go, like the restaurants and stuff now, all have handhelds and everything. I haven't seen any of them having a can of waiter or waitress. Everybody adapts, it seems.
Again, if you look at the services sector, you know, from and I'll go back to you know, ISM and look at it, you know, they're saying their business activity is up. It's well above the 54% mark, which is kind of their plus or minus area. New orders are up. Employment a little bit down, probably because they're automating so much. And supplier deliveries, you know, are up 54, you know, to that, you know, that's sitting at the 54.4%. So when you're on the plus side of 50 on theirs, that's a good thing. So, you know, their overall is higher on the services side. So that is your, you know, your restaurants, your order pickers, your people like that. But then you go back and say, do we have a labor force that is, you know, is built to contribute for manufacturing? And I would say the answer to that is that we're behind.
Well, this part of the labor force had to do all this continuing ed yesterday. And I got through it. You know, that's good. When you get your continuing ed from FINRA, everybody has to do it. But depending on how many numbers you have after your name, it gets longer and longer, Kevin. So if you're just a regular broker, you might have to do three or four. I got to do eight because of all the different numbers. And boy, what a pain that was. But it wasn't too bad. Actually, I learned some stuff, but it took a while. See, now I was able to take that on the computer. I didn't have to use a blue book. I adapted.
See, you adapted. But you wanted to use a blue book because you wanted to give them a much longer answer than what they were after.
No, I just wanted it over.
You wanted it over.
But you know, they talk about you know, you've been in the business so long, but there's all kinds of new nuances. It's funny how it's all changed. I mean, I've never had one like this year. They're talking about switching municipal bonds from place to place, and usually it was about branch office visits, and for a while it was really big on older customers and branch office visits and those kinds of things, and no, none of that was even added. I don't know why that was, but hey, what'd you make of? I thought the discussion yesterday with Lou really kind of piled on. When I say piled on, the stuff we were talking about earlier in the week about the lack of shipbuilding, and I'm always bragging about the lack of railroad car building and all the kinds of manufacturing that's right at the tip of your your fingers. I mean, you know, Bill Moriarty says that there's still a bunch of civil engineers because there's a lot of work going on all over the world, and some of these engineering companies now have like 40,000 people. So if you want to build a dam, there's people coming off a dam project in Argentina or some damn place.
And you I got that. I saw what you did, some damn place. That's pretty
good. Yeah, that's pretty good. But I just was, when Lou was talking about, you know, his view of what could happen in a new war, I mean, Jimmy and I were talking about it last night. Jimmy was a producer yesterday. He goes, you know, I never dreamed that once you have it, that the conventional wisdom is nobody is ever going to fire a nuke again, so every other war is going to be not nuke because everybody's afraid of doing it. And you really have to have your conventional basically crap together or else you're going to be in trouble because you're not going to start nuking people just because they take some of bases. I mean, and how the manufacturing and the mindset is kind of locked into, you know, it's almost like the battleship navy. It's now the aircraft carrier navy. And I thought Lou had some real interesting thoughts yesterday when we started lobbing ways to kill an aircraft carrier. I thought that was a little freaky, but what did you make of it without me talking?
Well, I thought it was real interesting to hear, and I hadn't really thought about, you know, I don't think about warfare very much at all anyway, but I hadn't thought of it like that, and that's why I love having Lou on the show, because he's going to give you some perspectives on that. But, you know, I do tend to agree, you know, if you have to use nuclear weapons, you have to be willing to die, and you're just saying, you know, I'm going down too, but it's worth it to me. You know, I'm going to, maybe if I'm going to lose anyway, if I'm going to, you know, be subjugated, then maybe it's worth it for me to take anybody down with me that I can. You know, that would have to be the mindset to do it, you know. Now, so who's crazy enough to do that? And you can start thinking of the international actors that might be crazy enough to do that.
Well, I think it depends kind of on the place. And again, I'm not the war games person. I mean, we being the US of A, from the 50s on forward, were always really big on the what they call it, the try-something-something, where we had bombers with nuclear capability, we had missiles, and we had submarines. So the idea was nobody could use any kind of nukes to take out essentially our nuclear capability. Because you can't take out the submarines, the Minutemen, and the airplanes all at the same time. I mean, nobody could do that, we think. But the idea was, if we had to use a nuke, say North Korea, they might only have two or three spots where they can launch anything from. I think it's been, I don't know, Kevin, as I'm asking, I think it's been in our mindset that if North Korea started to do some crap, and we dropped a couple of nukes on their two bases that are their entire capability of doing something, I'm not so sure we ever thought that was a strategic nuke like that was ever out of our playbook. I mean, now, that it's not the same as hitting a city. And if somebody only has one or two spots, I'm not so sure that wasn't in the playbook. What do you think?
Well, I think it has been in the playbook in the past, but, you know, I don't know that is where we really want to be, because this idea that we could start a war with tactical nukes and contain things from there, again, I think that could easily escalate into mutual destruction. That I go back and say, you know, who is crazy enough to do it? We would worry about someone like Putin saying, you know, if I have to lose, well, we're all going down. But wouldn't you worry more about a Islamist regime thinking, you know, I'm going to heaven?
Well, I think those guys, what was the book that Tom Clancy wrote where they blew one up in near the Super Bowl in Denver or something? What was the name of that book?
Some of All Fears.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, I mean, a nuclear device someplace or even something dirty enough to, even if it didn't blow too much, if it made an area, you know, you couldn't live in for a while, that's a problem. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can screw people over, it appears. You know, when you start thinking of that, I
go back and say, who is crazy enough to do it? Because that's where we worry, and that's why people were saying, well, you know, do we want Iran to have a nuclear weapon? You know, because there's you hear the arguments that, well, we got them, why shouldn't anybody else get them? Well, that's why, because they're crazy enough to use them.
Well, I mean, I was just kind of, I guess if we thought forward on it, we would think about it. But if what you're talking about is correct, Kevin, which I actually think it is, does that mean if all of a sudden one day China has, you know, 300 ships and they run over and take Taiwan before we can get, you know, three aircraft carriers over there and they got it, they're going to stare us in the face, we got it, now what? I mean, I think that's kind of what Lou is leading into, that they could just do that and there we were. We were basically sitting there.
And we can do about it. It stands to that.
You want to start nuking us, you know, or not? And I think the answer would probably be no. The Japanese probably could have done the same thing if they'd been a little smarter, you know, and declared war first or something, or not hit whatever they hit. But, you know, we might have.
Or do you think, you know, do you think the German Reich would have used a nuclear bomb, if they had gotten there first? Of course they would have.
Probably.
But I don't think. Even though everybody understood what they were trying to build, I don't think anybody really understood the implications of nuclear weapons in those days.
The people who were building them did.
We didn't know it until we dropped the damn things.
I think the people like Fermi and those guys knew. And they talked. They obviously convinced Roosevelt. I told you that story about in Freedom from Fear. The Germans were so. Well, they had their issues. But tactically, they were so screwed up that during the 30s, God, I wonder if somebody might remember, Carl might remember, didn't like 7 or 15 nuclear Nobel Prize-winning physicists were able to escape the Germans, and they were here? I mean, Enrico Fermi, all those guys were here. And Fermi was convinced that this could be a weapon, right? And he went to see an admiral. Well, I don't remember the name. And he's sitting in the outer office, and the captain's his orderly, or his gopher. And he says to the admiral, "There's some wop out here that wants to see you." So the admiral listens to Fermi, and paid no attention. Basically, didn't even run it up the chain. Somehow or another, Fermi was friends of a guy who was a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. And Eleanor Roosevelt said, "Hey, Franklin, you got to listen to this guy." So they scheduled like a 20-minute interview, 2 weeks out. He goes to the White House and picks his spiel with Roosevelt. Roosevelt, like, personally put the nuclear program on fast track. It wasn't the Army, it wasn't the Navy, it wasn't any of those people. He listened to the story and he goes, "You got to be kidding me that this thing is that kind of weapon." The Navy wouldn't listen at all, which is kind of typical of what Lou was describing the Pentagon of yesterday. So we ended up with, I think everybody says, "Oh yeah, the Germans could have done it." No, they couldn't have. We had something like, we weren't getting bombed, and I think there were something like 250,000 people working on the bomb project, from the digging the uranium to other stuff. And it was a massive undertaking that the German, you could never have done if people were bombing you, I don't think. But they would have, Carl knows, they would have probably gone the heavy water route, and they might have been able to do something that way, but. Still, it was kind of a big deal. But, that's kind of ancient history. But it is, when we actually dig into the history, it's always kind of different than people remember, huh, Kevin?
Well, yeah, but nevertheless, I think there's a case to be made that, that said at the time, in the 40s, that what you were really looking at was saying, we don't do it, they're working on it. You better be first, because if you aren't, sooner or later they're going to have some kind of success. What might it have taken them more years? Yeah, but if the war had dragged on that long, it probably would have. So that that has to go into your decision making process.
Oh, sure.
That was at the time. Now we know what the arsenals looked like. The arsenal was. One country at the time, the arsenal was one country had the ability to do it, and it's not like we were cranking out bombs by the dozens. It's a different decision process then than what we would be looking at now and for the use of it now.
So, well, you know, it drops into the same sort of category that we've been talking about. Well, what if, you know, let's go back to the how many shipyards do we have? What if the administration says we would like to have more capability than we have now? How rock bottom are we? Do we have no shipping engineers? Do we have no welders? I mean, how bad is it, do you think? I don't even know.
What's our lead time on it? Yep.
And what, you know, are there any of these places that used to be, maybe that still have a dry dock where we don't have to start from scratch? I mean, somebody's going to have to, I would hope that somebody in the administration says, give me a full report on this, will you? I mean, the guy might say, well, you know, five of them closed in the last 5 years, and the property's still there. And by the way, we're not starting from scratch because, you know, they have cranes, they have other stuff they haven't been able to sell yet. They're rusting, but they're still there. I mean, is it there, or are we going to look at a piece of farmland and say, you know, we're going to make a shipyard out of that? That would be something. I mean, there has to be somebody somewhere who knows the actual state of the business. Now, the Pullman plant, I'll tell you straight out, it's a Walmart. You know, so you're not getting anything out of that place. Now, are there other places that used to be shipyards? Are they Walmarts, or are they rusting? There's got to be somebody somewhere who knows some of this stuff, wouldn't you think?
And how specialized versus generalized is it? So, you know, if you're able to, are there other industries that could be, ramped up to start doing shipbuilding, or at least start the component pieces of it? Because there are a lot of companies that have excess capacity. Right now, they can start second shifts and third shifts. You're starting to see that in some of the industries that they're trying to reshore here. The point of it is that, there's always a ramp up time to start build a new factory and to start getting production up. Ramped up, but on the other hand, there are some opportunities for you to just go ahead and say, you know, you just start up another shift and it's lucrative for you, so you can do it. So, you know, that's usually not highly technical stuff, so we're not going to start chip factories, chip foundries in the United States, you know, that are going to be up and running in 6 months or 3 months or something like that. But there is other manufacturing that you can get going on it. You know, you can really goose it quickly and make it happen.
Well, plus from my end of it, when I say my end of it, I'm not a IPO guy, but somehow or another, whatever you're doing here has to be written up and planned in such a way where you can go to the capital markets and get capital for this. I mean, that's what the stock market... People ask, I wonder how many people know, what is the purpose of the stock market? The purpose of the stock market is to create a secondary market. So if you invest in a company that's an IPO of some kind, you know that there's going to be an active market for those shares afterward, that you're not investing for 100 years, you can't get your money out. It's not for gambling purposes. And the next IBM can go out and put shares out there and be traded in the New York Stock Exchange or the NASD, and you know you can get rid of the shares, and the prices move up and down with the value of the company. I mean, that's the whole theory of it. Anybody probably doesn't even know anymore, but that's what, you know, that's the whole idea. And I really don't want to see us go around our capital markets, and every one of these things is a Korean investment, you know, an Arab investment or something, and yet that's kind of what I'm seeing, Kevin. I would hope that maybe at least some of the other stuff, that if we're going to build something here and it is a Korean investment, that the other companies around it that supply it at least now are going to be capitalized from here and other places. Because I don't think our markets are dead that we can't raise money anymore. Do you?
Well, I do and I don't. I don't know if you're familiar with the Gartner Group.
I'm
absolutely certain Carl is familiar with the Gartner Group. They do a lot of they do a lot of things, but one of the things that they do is the evaluation of different technology products, some software, security systems, Jesus, different kinds of hardware and so on. And they have something that they use called the Magic Quadrant. And it's just a starting place as you start to look at different solutions, where you can go see what that evaluation looks like. And the Magic Quadrant is a two-factor analysis of different industries and different products within industries. And it's really two things. One axis is the completeness of the vision, and the other is the ability to execute on the vision for where the product is going. So if you're looking like for threat detection systems, and you look at a company, a Sophos or somebody like that, you say, are they going in the right direction, and are they doing the right things? That's part of the evaluation. But the other part of it is, can they pull it off? And I think that's what you have to ask when you're looking for investment for some of these companies. It isn't that people don't have good ideas, it's do they have the ability to execute on it? And I think that's iffy for a lot of American companies right now. They are so short-term oriented that they have forgotten about, how do you execute in the long term? I always say this, when I'm talking about capital expenditures in class. When I was early in my career and we were pitching capital expenditures, if it paid for itself in 3 years, that was fine. Everybody was okay with that. And that was even, at a time period when the interest rates were higher, so your hurdle rates were a little bit higher.
By the way, it's a hell of a return, by the way.
Yeah, well, now, later in my career, it was more like 18 months. And hey, by the way, can you squeeze that a little more and get it to 12? That's the thinking horizon for a lot of companies. And it really needs to be the other way. If you really want to revitalize industry in the United States, why are so many industries overseas? It's because of the cheap labor and so on. Well, how are you going to compete with that? How are you going to compete with the cost of labor in China when half of the labor is slave labor, which is really, really inexpensive? Or even if you're looking at Malaysia or Mexico or wherever you've taken the production, if you want to bring that back into the United States, labor is going to be much more expensive here. How do you work with that? Well, you're going to do it with automation. Then you're going to have to implement a much higher degree of automation than you get in the overseas production, so that your unit costs are competitive. But that means it's going to take you quite a while to recover the, get paid back for the capital expenditure. We know the shelf life of a lot of technology is much shorter than that horizon. But on the other hand, some basic robotics, automated production lines, things like that, that's not going to be obsolete nearly as quickly. Even if better stuff comes out, it's still going to have a pretty good useful life to it. And so are you willing to get a payback in 5 years on that? As long as it's paying for itself every day since when you implement it, are you willing to take a five-year horizon on it? And there aren't a lot of companies who think that way.
Well, also, you constantly hear people say, and I don't think they do it on purpose, that labor is cheaper, but labor is not equal everywhere. I mean, if you have a sweatshop and people are sewing blue jeans by hand, I guess it's equal. The minute you give somebody a sewing machine, it's not equal.
It's not, and we see that with suppliers, but there's a lot of companies that are saying, yeah, we get a fair amount of crap from our overseas suppliers, but they're so cheap that we're willing to live with that. We'll just outsource it. It's not like you can, put it in a box and return it because you don't want it anymore. So, that it doesn't work that way. But there's a lot of companies that just make the decision to live with it, because the unit cost of what they buy is so inexpensive.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with people here.
Get away with that because what's happening is a lot of that is finding its way into your production process. You don't catch it all before you go and use it. And when I see companies that are having, their first pass yield running at 90% or less, I'm sitting there saying, how expensive is it to make 10%, or even if they're 95%, to make 5% of what you make you can't sell, and it either needs rework or it needs to be scrapped altogether? How expensive is that? And don't don't complain to me about, you know, about inflation or about tariffs when you're your own worst enemy on the cost side of your business, because you make crap that you can't sell.
But you also have a lot of stuff people just want it cheap. I mean, and for reasons that are real reasons. I mean, I'm going to get the car here in a minute, but by the way, S&P futures were all backed on changed here, so not much going on. The you know, I used to, stupid as it may seem, Kevin, whenever I go down to Notre Dame after I graduated, I always buy a T-shirt. Not because I really cared about another Notre Dame T-shirt, but they used to sell champion T-shirts that I played handball or basketball pretty much every night. You could wash the damn thing 40, 50 times, and it was fine. It was really good stuff. It was worth $20 back in, you know, 1980. And, you know, then one day I walk into this Old Navy and I see all this stuff, and I'm going, God, this stuff's pretty cheap. Kevin, it was good for about 3 washings. But if you had a family and the kids are going to rip it and play football in it, whatever, and it's only going to last 2 weeks anyway, you don't care, right? It you know, it's just something to put on until they lose it or rip it. So, I mean, you know, there's different goals and. When you talk about, but I don't see how we're going to send.
That's you as customer defining what quality is, and that's okay.
We're not going to have South Korea build a submarine for us. I don't think, and give them all the technology.
It's not the point I'm trying to make. Yeah. The point I'm trying to make is, you know, what is your customer willing to pay you to do? Because you can't turn around and say, you know, my costs are high because of tariffs, or my costs are high because of inflation, so I have to pass that all on to you. A lot of your customers saying, that's your problem, that's not my problem.
Well, you have to cover
it. Your problem is to find a way to make it cheaper, and the easiest way to make anything cheaper is to stop making things you can't sell. I lay out, you know, in my quality class, first class, I tell them 4 words you need to know. Four words, and the first two I've heard before, but the second two I made up. The first one is called DIRFT, D-I-R-F-T. Do it right the first time. The next most expensive way is called DURST. Do it right the second time, okay? So a lot of times you just send it back for some rework and you're gonna be okay, but it's still, you've added cost to the process. The third word is TIASO, T-I-A-S-O, throw it away, start over. That's pretty damned expensive.
Oh, yeah.
Now you have to make two to sell one, to fulfill an order of one. So that's a problem. But the last one that's most expensive is called RIFPOC, Returned Item from Pissed Off Customer. And that's a very expensive way to make things. So you're paying to ship it, you're paying to ship it back probably, and you pissed off your customer along the way. There is too much of that built in, and you could, in this day and age, when we do have tariffs, for better or for worse, we have them, and we have had so much inflation, so much increased cost of parts, that if you don't deal with those issues, then you're killing yourself. You might have been able to get away with it once upon, you know, not too long ago, but you can't get away with it and operate profitably now. And that's, you know, that's what you're really looking at. So if you don't turn that boat around, and I work with companies that are working hard to try and turn that around, because if you don't turn that around, you're going to be screwed.
Hey, we got to let you dash here, but one question here is, we've talked an awful lot about you know, people giving money to the schools, and I'm changing topics here, but Nike had their earnings last night, and stock's down $7, like 10%. Stock's down to 58.17, and it was 175 in 2021. How well are they doing on this stuff, Kevin? Are they paying too much to these places?
Which places?
Well, I mean, the universities and stuff.
Sponsorship. Well, I don't know. That's marketing expense. You tell me. Is it effective marketing expense or not?
Well, I'm saying the stock is a quarter the price it was 3 years ago. So I don't know. Something's not right.
And we were talking about, you know, sales of merchandise as part of the value of the franchise.
Yeah.
How's that working, and how is and what kind of piece of that is Nike getting?
Yeah, man. I guess you know, since I was on a board once, I always figure that if somebody walked in and said, we're going to give, you know, Sidewash University $25 million, and by the way, we're going to pay their quarterback and their new defensive end, if I were to say, you know, okay, exactly what do we get from this? I don't know. Is there an answer? I mean, obviously, if Under Armour sells everything that our buddies buy when they go down to Notre Dame, it might be worth it. But is it really? I mean, what is the number on this stuff? Does any?
Yeah, what's the value of having that logo on every uniform on TV games? I don't know. You know, one area where I've never really developed the slightest bit of expertise is marketing. Especially advertising. I don't know what to tell you whether that's valuable or not, but you know, obviously somebody thinks it is.
Well, we have to go to Carl, but our buddy Chuck Henry, who was the president of CBOE, just the nicest guy and really smart. When I was chairman of the marketing committee, he says to me one day, he goes, "Tom, I know I'm pissing away half of my marketing money. I wish I knew which half."
That is exactly true, and I can tell you, as a guy who had to allocate those funds, that was always the question.
Well, you wonder if you go. I mean, I went down those days. We were still going down to spring training, and I went into Hohokam Park, where now somebody else is there, and the Cubs are some other place. But there had to be 50 Coca-Cola signs in the place, and I just. Can anybody tell me, God, what I remember, I used to know all these names, the marginal benefit of the 50th sign? I mean, I could see that if you're selling Coke in there, you want a couple of them. Is 10 the number? I mean...
Well, no, what the number is this is always kind of the challenge, right? So the logic that is, it's been around forever, is that you need 7 impressions in somebody's head in order to actually get any value at all from an advertising message. Okay, so basically, in order for it to stick long enough for them to act, you need 7 impressions. All right, now this, I'm sure social media and the internet and all this has changed some of that, maybe kind of, sort of, okay, but that's been the so-called rule ever since people started to try to take Freud's work and apply it to marketing and advertising.
It also depends on the medium.
Well, it does, but it doesn't. So the thing is that it's, but this goes back to when they first started to take psychology and basically grew Madison Avenue out of, your washing machine advertisement was about how well it washed clothes. Then it became how pretty it was, right? And we didn't have a frumpy looking woman, we had a big boobed 20-year-old woman, okay, that was selling washing machines.
That got me to buy.
Well, that's the thing though, that she's big boobed and cute does not make the washing machine work better. However, okay, but there are these chestnuts that have developed over the space of decades. And part of this is that saturation thing. But Chief, the question becomes, in that situation, where's the saturation point? Because N plus one is worth nothing beyond the saturation point.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's what I'm saying. I think the first sign you want in there, the second one you probably do, especially if it's far apart. Now you got 50. If somebody say we need the 51st, my first question is, Where are you going to put it? Why do we need it? I mean,
this is one of the challenges, right? And it's like, I used to do this all the time. Now today, we have all kinds of tracking that didn't exist before. All right, when I used to run promotional stuff, we always put something in the advertisement that was trackable. If someone called us and said, I want to buy internet service, right? There was always, it was always mentioned that. Why? Because otherwise I have absolutely no idea whether or not I'm whizzing into the toilet with all that money I'm spending.
Well, we used to, in banking days, we used to have a specific toll-free number that we would associate with each campaign, and that way you could see which what came in on that number.
Well, we did the same sort of stuff. We had, we had our circuits came in on a DS1, but we had, like 50 DID numbers on that DS1, right? So it, we had 800 numbers on there too. So you know, for people that were out of area, although since we were selling in the Chicago area, we didn't get a lot of traffic on those.
Well, and it doesn't matter anymore now because everybody's, you know, cell services doesn't matter.
Well, but it did.
Although people still have them. People still have them, and they still love their 800 numbers.
Well, no, there's actually a very good reason.
Hey, we got one.
Well, no, there's actually a very good reason why 800 numbers still have value. So for local numbers that you have, you know, your cell phone number, whatever, those have what we all know of as caller ID, right? In that the supposedly who's calling you, that can be blocked at the originating caller's request. In addition, it can be spoofed. Mm-hmm. For people that are using SIP trunks, if they're using an IP phone of some kind. This is one of the reasons you have all these scammers that call you and, you know, supposedly the number comes up as your local power company or something like that, right? That's because that number can be set. 800, all toll-free numbers, give the owner of the number what is called ANI, which is the actual billing number of the caller. And the reason is you're paying for the call. Okay. So that is in many cases, that is a very valuable piece of information. And so that, I mean, even in today's world where, you know, nobody really cares, there actually is a reason to, you know, to do that, because then you as the customer, the person who owns the 800 number, get that information, and that you cannot block. So if you call an 800 number and you have caller ID blocked, doesn't matter. The owner of the number gets the calling number because he's paying for the call.
Interesting. Okay. Well, anyway,
there are some ways to measure effectiveness.
Yeah.
Some, not all.
Well, it depends on your goal, Kevin. When I say your goal is that the first thing I had to learn, you know, I mean, I think most people. There's a massive difference between marketing and PR, and virtually nobody knows what it is.
Well, you know, we've changed so much. You know, you have to wonder though, Chief, how much of this? Like, there's always been, you know, marketing is the art of it is puffery, right? And to some extent, so is public relations. But just look at what happened yesterday.
Well, I'm saying, let me give a quick definition. Then marketing is for something that people buy often enough where you can change their behavior.
Right.
PR is, the difference between, I'll use the two examples in a Super Bowl commercial, it's GoDaddy and Pepsi.
Yeah.
Now, Pepsi, people, you know, a lot of people buy pop, every soda, whatever you want to call it, every day. So if they put on a big run at a Super Bowl, Pepsi could clock, and I've read some of the analysis, the next 2 to 3 weeks, and then it kind of falls off, they would get like a 1% or 2% bulge over Coke for several days in a row, and then it would drop down. But you could, that's something you could buy tomorrow. Now GoDaddy, remember those guys where they had
You
went online and they had the ladies undressing, the commercial that they wouldn't allow on the Super Bowl, so everybody's watching. Well, nobody's going to go out and get an IP address just because you like the girl in the commercial. It's embedded in your brain that someday, 3 years from now, if you buy a business and you need a couple things, oh yeah, I love the commercial for these guys. Maybe 3 years later you're going to go, but you're not going to go get it tomorrow. It's like Alka-Seltzer. You're not going to go out and buy Alka-Seltzer tomorrow if you don't have a bad stomach, even though the commercial was terrific.
Well, and again, that's puff. It's all puffery,
right,
though, because if you remember them because they had a cute girl in the ad or a cute guy if you're a woman, okay,
yeah.
you certainly didn't do it on the strength of their technical expertise.
No,
okay, so I mean, you know, because how do you document that in a 30-second spot? You can't. But that's one of those things. The thing that I think is so fascinating, though, is how it has dumbed down so many of the things. You know, like you guys were talking about the CPI thing earlier, right?
Talk about dumbed down.
Well, I didn't even do an article on it because the release came out. Of course, you know, the futures do this rocket shot thing, And I'm looking at the data table. I said, I can't actually come up with anything actionable out of this because they stripped so many of the elements.
Okay, but now you're being Carl.
Well,
the headline number was supposed to be year over year 3%, and the only number that came out said it was 2.7%. It looked like a tremendous piece of paper, but there was nothing else that came out.
But the point is, Jay, I'm looking for something that I can trade on. Okay.
Well, but I'm saying if you have there's mopes in this world that I won't say mopes because they're pretty sophisticated. That as soon as that thing came out, I'm going to say that there's got to be 15 firms that have futures orders in and stock orders in. I'm going to say as soon as that number came out, the 2.7 versus 3, without even knowing that the rest of the page was blank, a zillion people pulled offers.
Well, yes, Ed, but here's the problem. I'm a retail guy sitting behind a desk with a computer. I'm not fast enough to be able to get in front of that or in the middle of it. I'm going to get run over if I try to trade the
reaction. Well, if you were me and you put in a market order, now we hopefully are smart enough not to, you put a market order in to buy the futures.
And I get smacked.
The smacking before that, you think you're going to get filled at, where are they trading now, 67.82? And all of a sudden you're filled at 67.98?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, I'm going to get run over by a freight train, okay? So, no thank you. I didn't get the number in advance like, certain people might have. You never know who might have been there. Where'd all the people up in the stack, where'd they get there? How come that guy's got a resting order there that's, half a point off the market? Doesn't really matter from that standpoint. What I thought was just fascinating was later on in the day, and I sent you guys an email. I put it up on the list. You have the Labor Department chick that Trump has hired. Okay, so administration shill gets out there and is spinning the unemployment number going up. And saying, well, it's because people came off the couch. So I'm like, wait a minute. I do the I report on this thing every month, right? First Friday. I'm sitting there with bated breath. I've got my espresso in me. I don't remember the not in labor force number going down anytime during the year. I mean, it goes up and it goes down on a monthly basis, but annualized year over year, I don't think so. Maybe I had too many beers last night, at the bar. Maybe my, I'm a little addled. Let me go look. So I pulled the thing up. I said, you lying sack of crap. I thought so.
Well, the theory, and by the way, taught me more on this other, what they're all, the other people in our world, the theory of it was, God, Carl, this goes back to when I was in college, okay? The theory of it was, if the economy picked up, and all of a sudden people who had dropped out of the workforce
came in,
yeah, and started looking for a job, that theoretically your people looking for a job could actually go up, it's not a bad thing, it's a good thing. But I tried to cover, I don't know if you were listening earlier, I tried to cover with Kevin a little bit.
Yeah,
there's no way to count those people.
Well, no, Chief, here's the thing, okay? I sent this thing around. The bottom line is that from January, the unemployment rate, the official unemployment rate is 4%, 4.0, all right? And this last report's 4.6. It essentially, her argument is that the not in labor force number has gone down as people are coming back and looking for work.
She probably never actually said that. She implied it.
No, she did say
it. She did say it? Wow.
She said people are coming back into the workforce looking for jobs, and that's why the rate's going up.
I'll bet she didn't even, well, I'm saying that would be the party line from 50 years ago.
Well, okay, yeah. But that's what she said.
Yeah,
okay?
I get it.
And that is a lie.
Let me ask you this question.
All right, but it's
right what you're talking about. Is there any way, you and I have talked 10 times, that right now the only way somebody's considered looking for a job is they're actually getting the unemployment check? Is there any way that I could get my my dead ass off the sofa and apply for a job tomorrow that anybody would know I did that?
Yeah, because the household survey, this is where the NILF number comes from. They ask specifically, which is why you also have unemployed or underemployed for economic reasons, which is another table in the report. Okay, so the household survey is where that number comes from. So if you are looking but have not found, you're in there. Now, if you're not looking for whatever reason, then you're in NILF. All right, now you're in the not in labor force number. So here's the other problem.
So it has nothing to do with how many unemployment checks are going out.
Well, it does. The unemployed number is how many checks are going out.
Well, that's what I mean, yeah.
Right, but the not in labor force number is not.
Right.
It is not employed minus the number of unemployment checks going out, okay? It isn't. It's not labor force means not you're couch surfing. You're living in your mom's basement, not trying to get a job. You're, you know, playing video games all day. We don't know what the hell you're doing, but what we know what you're not doing is attempting to be employed, okay? Now, maybe the reason is you're disabled and can't work. Right. I mean, you know, there's 100. You're not institutionalized. You're not in.
Well, you could be retired. You could be a student.
Well, you're not in a nursing home, and you're not in jail. Okay, you know, because that's what the non-institutional employment, you know, the population number is. But here's the other aspect of this. All right, so from December, if you take a 12-month look at this, which you have to, because you have to look at the annualized stuff, otherwise all the knob twisting gets you that the BLS does, which is why I always use the unadjusted numbers. But December, you know, Thanksgiving always comes in November, Christmas always comes in December. From November of last year to November of this year, the employment population ratio is down by 2 ticks. That's the end of the conversation. That's 1.2 million people. That's each tick in that number is 600,000 employed people.
I know I'm beating the dead horse here, but if I get laid off and I'm for the 26 weeks I get a check, I'm supposed to be looking for a job. I'm counted as unemployed because I'm not working looking for a job, correct?
That is correct.
Now, the day that the check stopped coming, I thought they were starting to cheat, and now they immediately put me in the other column that I was no longer looking, even though I probably still am. I might even be looking harder because I'm not getting a check.
No. You come out of the unemployed column.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
But not necessarily in not in labor force. Not in labor force comes off the household survey.
Okay. All right.
All right. So there's if you look at the tables, you see that like the there's subtables under the main. So the primary number is the non-institutional working age population, right? And then you have the sub entries underneath that. But when you come out of the unemployed number, you don't necessarily go into not in labor force.
Okay.
What you do is come out of unemployed.
Well, you should. And you got to go somewhere.
Well, but but you're still in the non-institutional working age population. Okay. I mean, the thing is this: if you take all these numbers and you add them all up, you'll see that there's issues, okay, to put it mildly. But the unemployed, the actual unemployed number is quite small.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's why it's a crummy number. But
it's a worthless number.
I'm trying to be charitable here. Imagine that. I'm trying to
why?
Find. Well, I don't know. I'm saying if all of a sudden the world got better tomorrow, and 20,000 people said, "Man, I looks like I can go find a job now," and they went out and actually started looking that weren't. I'm trying to figure out. Could it be possible that someday she could be right? She isn't now. My question is it possible that someday she could be right? Not just be right, but those people actually get counted. I don't see where they get counted.
Kind of, sort of, no.
Yeah.
Okay. But here's the other thing too is that from November 24 to November 25, the unemployed number is up from 6708 to 7401. Okay, so if you want to look at her argument as that is people looking for work, because theoretically you're supposed to be in order to get the check, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, you can make that argument. All right. So, I mean, if you take the NSA number from, you know, from November to November, that number is higher.
Well, plus, okay. we're going to dash off here, but the number you're talking about is the combined of the two, the people that are either officially unemployed or not in the workforce versus the people that are actually working.
Well,
and that number keeps dropping, and that's horrible.
Well, what she's looking at, I mean, if I look at this and I'm trying to come up with how do I justify making a statement like that, I'll tell you where she got it from, is under the not in labor force number, there's a sub-entry under there, people who currently want a job, which went from 5133 last year to 5774.
She got it from the last person to get their ass fired, get out there and say something good or I'm firing you.
Yeah. So, I mean, statisticians can always find a way to lie, right, if they want to. If they want to find something that's a complete load of
crap. 111 million people that are not doing anything. That's the problem.
Well, the employment population ratio over the last 12 months is down by 2 ticks. That's the end of the conversation.
Yeah, it's the end of the conversation. It really doesn't matter whether they're looking or not. They're not working.
They're not working. And that number's down by 2 ticks. And each of those ticks is 600,000 employed people.
And if it gets down to like 55%, I think we go under.
Well, we're not already going
under.
I was going to say, we're already sucking water. We're you know, bobbing our head above trying to get a little bit of air in here. But we're already sucking
that
water.
That number has to be, in my estimation, give me yours, that number has to be about 65 or 6 for us to be healthy.
We're able to be more or less okay with that figure in the 62-63 range.
Okay, so I mean, I'm being a little harsh then, but that's how many. But okay, so if it's 63, that's
65 would be good.
Okay, so that's 3.4, and every point is 600,000. That's a lot of people.
Yes, it is. It's 6 million for every full percent.
That would be working that now aren't instead of paying. That's a big difference.
Right. This goes back to what I've said about the whole thing about, you know, the shift, whether you like it or not, with the refugees and everything else. The reality is if you can't earn because you're just incapable if you don't have the chops for what you have to have to be productive in the American economy at a level that is greater than what you consume, you are going to damage that number. There isn't any way around it. Well, that's not a sociological argument. It's a fact.
S&P futures up 4, Nasdaq futures up 48. So we're trying to make it to the upside here. We're going to go to a quick break, and we'll do all the numbers, which we didn't know them earlier, and we'll be back to keep jousting with Carl here. It's always fun. Be right back. Stocks and Jacks.
Listen, are you a 50-year-old person looking for term life insurance? Then you need to talk to Bob. Bob specializes in helping people find $1 million or more of term life insurance for a couple of $100 a month. Look, you need to know there's a price war in the term life insurance business, and you may be paying too much. Call Bob, and he'll shop and see how much money he can save you. Look, this could be the last term life insurance policy you ever have. Your rates are guaranteed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rates for the next 20 years. And if you're a smoker or your health is not perfect, Bob has great rates for you too. So for $1 million of term life insurance coverage for a couple of $100 a month, call Bob right now. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. That's 800-989-1415. Paid for by Term Direct.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell. We've got Carl on the phone or on the whatever it is, and we have Ricky on the board. We have S&P futures up 3, and Nasdaq futures up 47. Now we're flipping over today from the March and the December is both trading. I think on the opening this morning here the December will stop trading, and we'll be into the SPHs, which is the March. The Decembers were the I believe the X's. And the spoos are September, and the M's are June. For those that Probably don't care, but that, every month has a letter. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 22.1%. FTSE up 4, call that flat. CAC around down 6, call that flat. So those guys are in holiday mode over there. Asia, however, not so much. Nikkei is up after being down earlier in the week. Up 505, that's a full 1%. Got the Hang Seng up 192.7%, Shanghai up 14.3%. Japan stocks and bond yields jump after central bank hikes policy rate the highest in decades. Yeah, the Japanese central was zero for like forever. Well, now it's not. It's up to almost like 2 or something. Bonds, 10-year up 2 basis points, 4.14. The Bund up 3 basis points, 2.88. Again, these 10-years are not going down, even though the Fed has been lower in the short term. Oil up 43 cents, but still 56.58, under 60 now for quite a while. Gold, which has been on a tear, is now calm the last couple days. It's down 80 cents. 43.63. Silver, however, is up another 68 cents, 65.90. It's a full percent. Silver has really been doing way better than gold. We have some people into that, and they're pretty happy lately. Dollar, the euro is still at 117, no change there. British pound, no change, 130, almost like 134. Crypto, which has been all over the place, up 2,900 today, 87,874. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports? It's nasty out.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 7:35 here in Chicago, 14 degrees right now with a high of 25, breezy and much colder with clouds giving way to some sun. Tonight will be mostly cloudy and breezy and not as cold with a low of 23 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 53 degrees right now with a high of 77, warm with plenty of sun. Tonight will be clear to partly cloudy with a low of 50 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Edens is looking pretty clear right now. There's a little backed up on Kennedy. There's an accident eastbound on Eisenhower before Des Plaines Avenue. The left lane is closed and expect delays up to 5 minutes. Additionally, there's a Bull Riders event at the United Center tonight, so that might cause some delays on Eisenhower as well.
A Bull Riders event.
That's right. Other than that, we have some minor congestion on Stevenson and then Ryan heading into the city. Let's talk sports. Blackhawks lose to Canadiens yesterday 4-1, and they are now 7th in Central Division with a 4-loss streak. We have the Seahawks barely beating Rams 38-37 yesterday after going to overtime. And this Saturday, we have Eagles at Commanders at 4 p.m. and Packers at Bears at 7:20 p.m. Lastly, this Sunday, we have Falcons at Cardinals. NBA the Suns beat the Warriors yesterday 99-98. With 24 points by Dylan Brooks. And lastly, we have Bulls at Cavaliers today at 6:30 p.m. Back to you, Chief.
Are you a rodeo guy?
Not really. It depends. If I'm in the right mood, I'll go watch one.
Audrey dragged me to one up the. That was the one up this at the. What's the center where DePaul used to play? It's one by O'Hare. Ricky, tell us the name of that place. It used to be the Horizon. I don't know what it is now, but
yeah, that's well. They used to have concerts and stuff there.
Yeah, that's what DePaul played there for a while. And
long time ago, I went there. Yeah.
So what brings me to this rodeo? You know, this is things you got to do if you're the boyfriend, right? And of course, she loves horses and all this kind of stuff. She'd love to have another horse. She had a beautiful horse. Poor guy had cancer. He was like 25 or something.
Ow.
He looked just like he was buckskin. He looked just like Ben Cartwright's horse. Only he was better looking. But the first guy's riding a horse. He comes by right where we are. They got like these temporary fences up.
Yeah.
Well, he whacks into the fence, and all the dirt like flies all over me. And I'm going, well, that's cool. That's like 30 seconds into the event. And then some other guy gets flipped off a bull like 5 minutes later, and they got to get the ambulance to pull him out of there. Just like 5 minutes into the event, I've already got doused with the dirt and whatever else was in there. And I can see the guy hauled away on a stretcher, and I'm going, this is going to be a great evening.
Yeah, here we go, right.
Like, exactly. God. Anyway, can you summarize some of the week when we're talking about the numbers kind of not being there, some of the education maybe is not being there, and we see whole industries that, if you've never been around an industry like that, I mean, I have in rail cars, so I have some sense of, and rail cars are not the same as a jet engine or a B-52.
Right.
I mean, they're design build, they're a year-long project, and there's a, 25,000 parts on it, but there's not a million parts on it. The idea that you could open up a place, Carlin Chief Shipbuilding, and get a a contract for a destroyer or something with somebody giving you, or even a, you know, even a cruise ship or a frigate, and somebody to give us a performance bond, what manner of moron would do? I mean, this is, these are, I mean, Pullman didn't even have to pay for their performance bond because they'd never reneged on a contract in 110 years.
Well,
but how
yeah,
do you how do you get a history? How, I mean, this, when you talk to people that have, like, I'll say, regular jobs that have never been exposed to that, they have no idea what I'm talking about when I talk about the complexity and the timing and the people and the drawings and the
Well, of course they don't. You know, but it look, there's the basic mismatch that we have right now. Right? I mean, I had to put an article up on this the other day too. This craziness. All right, so of course the data center thing comes with this secondary problem, which is that if I build this building and I stuff it full of chips, and you know, I buy 5,000 computers to go in the racks in this big building, right? All right. Now I have a building, but it needs electrical power. And you cannot get the connection. It's not like building a house where you call up the utility. And as part of your permitting and your planning, whatever, you call up the utility and they, oh yeah, okay, you know, and they drop a 4-aught into, you know, in the trench, and put it in the meter box, and when you get your final on the electrical, the guy comes out there and slaps a meter in there, and there's 200 amps of electrical service. Okay,
yeah.
I mean, you know, that's basically what happens with the house. Don't work like that in industrial, at all. The utility operator in that area has to take a look at, okay, how many amps of service do you want at what voltage? What do you want to buy? And then they have to look at their load calculations on the infrastructure from wherever they're buying or generating their power, depending on whether they actually are a generator or they're just a distribution operator. And all the infrastructure all the way to your building where you're going to put this thing, and they have to say, well, you know, can we actually deliver this? Can we do this? If the answer is no, until they can do it, you don't get connected. You can't manifest electrical power. You can't wave a magic wand and make it appear.
Well, let me give everybody a serious real-world example of what Carl just said. There was a place by me. Do you remember when you were in Chicago, the Finkelsteel?
Yeah.
Finkelsteel was on North Avenue, right. Actually, no, it was on Clybourne. Not Clybourne. It was on. It was on both, actually, but it was on both sides of Armitage, basically, there with Cortland, which is where, and they were. And then there was some of it was on North Avenue. So Jan and I would drive by there, and they was a steel company where they made stamping dies. So I don't know if they actually made the steel from scratch, but they had to do a lot to it because stamping die is real serious steel.
Yeah.
And when Jan and I would go by there, we're doing a show on the score from 5 to 6 in the morning. So we're driving by there at 4:30. Well, they had the doors were all open, and you could see this hearth in there.
Yeah.
They had an open hearth, but the hearth was electric.
It's an arc furnace. Yeah.
Imagine. So you say, what are these guys doing there at night? Well, Chicago had all these nukes and other stuff where the electricity at night was dirt cheap.
Right.
So these guys had power coming into this place like there's no tomorrow. And they decided they were going to move the steel company in the middle of, you know, residential neighborhood. They needed more room, so Mayor Daley essentially swapped him some property there from somewhere over on the east side where the steel companies used to be. It was about a 6 month, because I know, because one of the guys in the local tavern is an electrical guy, and he goes, it was about a 6 month to a year project to get that kind of power into the new place on the east side.
Yeah.
It's not just, like Carl said, you don't go out to the wires, which is 440, and plug in and all of a sudden start an arc furnace. That's not happening. I mean, what do they have to bring? I mean, what kind of wiring do they have to...
Well, it depends on what's in the area where you're going. Okay, so one of the siting considerations with places like this is where are you putting this facility in reference to existing transmission infrastructure? So if you happen to be, you know, next door to an existing substation that has the capacity to serve you, okay, that's you know, maybe that's not so bad.
Well, that area used to have a lot of mills and manufacturers, so probably there was some infrastructure there.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, that's not so bad. Now, maybe there's a 1,500 foot or, you know.
Well, I guess my question is, what kind of wire do you need, or wires?
Well, the gambit there, basically the way this works is that, you know, watts is volts times amps, right?
Right.
So the and you size conductors for amperage. So if you are pulling in large amounts of power, you want to take it at a higher voltage, because that it, and so does the utility, because the amperage goes down ratably with the voltage going up, and therefore the size of the conductor that you need is less.
That's why the voltage is 220 in Europe and not 110, right?
Because
the wires are smaller, right?
Yeah, it's part of the reason. There's a lot of really hinky, like, weird stuff related to, you know, why are we AC as opposed to DC, and there's a lot of history behind this. Okay, some of which
it was Edison versus Tesla, right?
Yeah, well, there was all kinds of debate over the safety of the two. As it turns out, you know, today it's less important because we have solid state inverters and things like this. But one of the problems that you have with any kind of long distance transmission is that you think the wire doesn't have any loss in it, but it does. And so you want to regenerate the power. And for AC, you have to, because of phase shift on long lines. But converting the voltage of a DC voltage, today we can do it without too much trouble with semiconductors, but doing it back before those was a near impossibility. Okay, so you had to use a motor generator. It was expensive as hell, and a lot of loss was involved. And so as a result, what you had was AC1, on some maybe spurious arguments, but on some others that were not, which is that transformers make it very easy to transmute between volts and amps. Okay, so you want very high voltage for long distance transmission, but you obviously don't want to get within, you know, a foot of a wire in your house and have it jump to you and kill you.
But they would. They're not going to put those kind of wires on your normal wire in a backyard. Just hop from neighborhood to neighborhood, are they?
No. Well, most of the distribution cabling in a neighborhood is typically, 7,200 volts is not an uncommon frequency or an uncommon voltage.
Well,
so it's quite a bit higher than you think it is. Okay. But obviously the line, you know, that transformer sitting on the pole, if you've got exterior wiring that, you know, that comes into your house, what's coming into your house is what's called, in the U.S. anyway, it's called split phase. It's actually 240, even though it's not fed that way to most of your appliances, except for your dryer and your range and, your air conditioner. But it actually is 240, which is what your single phase current is.
Well, you come in, it's two 120s to add up. You can put them together, right?
Well, it's two. It's split phase. So
yeah.
When one is going positive, the other is going negative, which means you can center tap it and use 120 volts, and you can use both sides and have 240 volts.
I think this was a real big deal when I think this is somewhat interesting. Maybe other people do too. And when you end up, the original trains were. The locomotive just gave you traction power. Like the
right.
You see the big boy pulling the freight cars?
Yeah, yeah.
It gave you traction power, and it gave you compressed air for the brakes.
Right.
And but then when you went to push pull cars, for the Northwestern, which Pullman made, all of a sudden now the power had to come all the way through the train, because your train, you could drive the thing from the other end.
Right.
So then all of a sudden now, originally there were generators. Remember your old bike where you had a little generator on there and powered your headlight?
Yeah.
Well, that's essentially what happened in trains. There was a generator on the wheel, which again the locomotive pulled, and that created all the power for the individual car, even like the dining car. And there were there's a big row of batteries on there
to hold it up
when all of a sudden you stop, you'd still have your lights on. So, but now when you came the other way, the locomotive now provides the electrical power as well, which actually is harder than the traction power. Because, if you have a, you'll see sometime a Metra train or an Amtrak train, and there's there's like 10 cars on it, and you see two locomotives, and you go, those must be kind of weak locomotives. No. One locomotive could easily pull the thing. That's not the point. It's running the air conditioners on 10 cars that's the problem.
Yeah, you need the power.
But I think, if my memory serves me correct, I think the original DC coming off the locomotive is like 660. And then it drops. They drop it to 440 for like work. 440 works something. I don't know if it's the air conditioners or some compressors. Then you get down, the actual lights are like your fluorescent light in your house. They're 120. So there's all kinds of electrical stuff going on in these rail cars.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it's the same thing, you know, in many other environments. This is the... If you want actual... You know, if you're pulling industrial type of power, there's another problem, which is, like, you know, you were talking about the place that had the arc furnace. There's a problem with equipment like that in that it has there's a thing called power factor, and essentially what that amounts to is that when the alternating current, you would think that as the voltage goes up, you know, it's a sine wave, right? So it goes up and down. As it goes up, that the amount of amperage would go up equally as that draw goes up, right? As the voltage goes up. So the differential goes up, that means more amps. Okay, well, that's if it is an exact match, that's power factor 1.0, which is great for everybody. The problem with things like an arc furnace is that they have very poor power factor. So their amperage draw is not aligned with the voltage. The same thing with computer power supplies, unless they're corrected for it. And that's a serious problem because the power company has to deliver the amps regardless of where in the cycle it is. And if it can't, then, okay. So consumers, your house, you do not pay for this. But any industrial user of power does. They get hit with a power factor charge.
Any high-rise does. The day you turn on the air conditioner, it's a huge draw on everybody.
Well, and so motors tend to have a skewed power factor as well, okay? But some things like an arc furnace are especially bad. So, and a lot of computer equipment is really horrible also.
Just for everybody who's listening, the theme of this conversation is, we've talked for 10 minutes, and hopefully we haven't put anybody to sleep, about something that is probably one millionth of the decision-making process of a new shipyard.
Yeah.
If you've never done it, nothing is easy.
No, it's not. And you know, the thing is, though, is that this is one of the things that you're seeing is, and I think this dislocation is coming. I'll let people in on one of the predictions I have for this coming year. This whole AI thing, the entire gambit on this is going to come apart on people. But here's the reason I brought this up originally is, and I think it's next year. We get the dislocation next year on this. But just a couple days ago, Trump's media company turns around and does one of those stuff a private firm into a public company game things with this company that thinks they have a fusion answer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw
okay?
that.
You know,
fusion meaning essentially a hydrogen bomb nuclear plant.
A controlled hydrogen. Yeah, a controlled fusion, right?
Well, right, Matt, now most people, the regular ones are fission versus fusion, correct?
Correct. Fusion has an advantage in that it doesn't produce a huge amount of radioactive waste, okay? And by the way, it's also what that big flaming ball in the sky uses. Okay.
Yeah, the sun is a major fusion reactor.
Yeah, exactly. That's basically what it is. The problem is that we've been able to actually create fusion. It requires a great deal of heat and pressure. We've been able to create it for a hell of a long time. What we've never been able to do is actually get a surplus of energy back out compared to what we put in. And they all say, oh, it's just around the corner. Just around the corner. We're going to have it next year. We're going to have it 10 years from now. In 10 years, you're going to have too cheap to meter electricity. Well, there's several different entities that have been trying to come up with an answer to this. But what people don't understand is that achieving break-even, which none of these have, by the way, does not solve the problem. If you look at a conventional nuclear plant, a regular old-fashioned, you know, Zion or wherever, right? That plant requires about 10% of its nameplate rating. So let's say it produces a gigawatt of power at you know, that one reactor unit makes a gigawatt of electrical power out the back end. It needs 100 megawatts to start. And the reason is that it needs that for the pumps, the controls, all the other stuff.
Just to get, well, make a simple example. A stick of dynamite doesn't do you any good until you light it. Well, you have to put the energy in it, but the energy you get coming out is a lot more.
You got to put the cap in there, yeah, in order to initiate, yeah, it. Otherwise, it just burns like a candle.
Yeah.
Okay. So the thing is that, so this is why a nuclear plant cannot black start, cannot start from a zero condition with no grid, because there isn't 100 megawatts of electrical power available from the emergency generators. There just isn't enough capacity on site to start.
So you need electricity to generate. It's not like a waterfall.
Well, by the way, a coal-fired power plant has the same problem, because the augers and the blowers and all the preheat and all that other stuff requires a huge amount of electrical power. So what they typically do is they have a gas turbine that's sitting there that has enough energy to start the coal plant. Okay.
Well, in the old days, the steam from the coal powered all the pumps. That's not the way it works anymore. You get the pumps first.
Yeah, but the thing is that, I mean, the point being, these utility scale things all need a huge. So if you take a look at the energy budget on this, you have 10% of the nameplate rating of the nuclear plant, but it's actually worse than that, because that nuclear plant that makes a gigawatt of electrical power makes 3 gigawatts of thermal heat power and deliberately throws 2/3 of it away. That's why it's got to sit on a huge body of water, and that's because of the laws of thermodynamics, which nobody can cheat. Okay, you cannot cheat those laws. So these people that say, well, if we get to break even, we've got fusion power. No, you don't. You have to overcome the thermodynamic losses in converting to electricity.
Yeah, but his name's on it, Carl. That's the goal.
Well, you know what? His name's on it, and these guys, the press release said that they're going to break ground on a commercial nuclear plant this coming year in 2026.
We have a guy who wants his name on everything, and he doesn't care if the truth follows anything. So that's
Chief,
what you just described.
There is no effing way that in 2026, these guys are going to put on the ground with a shovel something that, you know, 2-3 years from now is actually feeding electricity.
It might not even be a fusion plant. It might be a fission plant. They don't care what they say.
You know what? It might not ever produce a single watt of power in the grid, too.
But as long as he's got the sign out front, what's the difference?
He got a 40% crank on the stock price in one day.
I've always been.
By the way, it's up again this morning, pre-market.
Yeah, I know. I saw it. I saw. You know, this whole thing about somebody was always had something to do all day long, right? If I was a president, it would be a full-time job. Just saying.
I don't think.
How would I have hours enough in the day to figure out a way to weasel me and my family in every one of the deals? I mean, how many people are working on that there in the West Wing that have nothing to do with our country? I mean, this is serious effort. I mean, I'm not talking about whether it's right or wrong, and people can have different.
But it's
serious effort that every single time the president makes a trip to cut a ribbon at a new place, he leans over and says, "What's our cut?" I mean, not only is it, in my mind, kind of sleazy, but it's also a lot of work.
Well, the thing that I have no problem with something, you know, in the general sense. I mean, leave aside the nepotism and all the other crap, okay? But I would like to see actual innovation and things that move the country forward, all right? That would be nice. But this sort of stuff pisses me off, because, and I'm not saying that it's impossible that somebody will crack this code. I'm just saying that I'm 62 years old, all right? And Fermi, by the way, you want to know another one? Gates has his fission project, which, oh no, we're not going to do molten salt. This is a brand new thing using liquid sodium for cooling. And somebody sent me an email the other day on this, and I said, you know, that is not new. In 1963, Fermi 1 went critical in Monroe. 1963, Fermi 1 was a small core, highly enriched uranium breeder reactor, and the coolant was liquid sodium. And yet, Gates is saying this is an innovative.
Because who remembers but you?
Does anybody...
There's going to be somebody come out tomorrow that says he innovated sex. Yet he got here somehow.
Chief, that was 60 years ago.
I know. So who remembers?
I just, that stuff, I'm like, are you out of your blanket? By the way, there are good points and bad points to using liquid sodium as a coolant, okay? There are. I could go through a two-hour dissertation on the good and the bad, okay? It's got both good and bad points. But this fusion stuff, it's like, you know, and then you got these helium guys that claim that they have figured out how to do direct conversion of the magnetic containment energy in the fuser back into grid power. And I'm like, you know, again, anytime somebody tells me that they have essentially figured out how to get very close to breaking the laws of thermodynamics, you know, we got 95% recovery. I'm like, I have never in my lifetime seen efficiency numbers like that, except in certain very rare instances, like
and you're the only guy. It's, what do they say? If you can't dazzle them with brilliance, you baffle them with bull.
Baffle them with bull crap, right? And it's like, and you know what? I see the turds streaming out of the back of the bull when I hear stuff like this.
Well,
right?
I remember being, I liked the. We always had Oldsmobiles in the family, right? So Oldsmobile came out with this Tornado, which was front wheel drive, and they said how revolutionary it was. And my uncle sitting next to me goes, what do you mean? The cords were all front-wheel drive in the 30s. By the way, I drove one of those one night, those Tornados. The regular was a 425, and the regular one was 375 horse. And if you wanted, they had a special model that was 400 horse.
Yeah.
And one of my buddies' dad used to rent cars, and he goes, I'm coming over, we're going for a ride. And I go, what do you mean, going for a ride? He goes, you can just drive around. We'll play some music. You got to drive this car. And I got to drive the thing one night. God, you could barely touch the gas without your butt going back in the seat. It had power like there was nothing like power. I mean, it was pretty serious. I mean, or I guess that's more torque than power, right?
It's all about where the power is delivered, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it was. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it didn't have as much horsepower as some of the modern engines, but in terms of torque, boy, it was. Next week we're doing a show on Friday, so we'll have you Wednesday and Friday as usual, or Tuesday and Friday as
usual.
We have to maneuver our we have to get Wayne and Andrew in someplace, and Kevin are losing to probably pile in with Kevin one day. So we'll get everybody around, because we don't want to miss anybody between now and the end of the year. Christmas on a Friday is kind of a pain in the ass, but on a Thursday.
It's got its good and bad points.
Well, it does. But it's. We work all day Friday, and the half day is Wednesday, and now New Year's Eve is never a half day, and I have to go to a wedding on New Year's Eve, which is even worse. It'll be interesting next couple of weeks. SP futures up 450, NASDAQ futures up 54. We'll see if we're going to leak into the end of the year. I don't think we are. I think we're going to have some volatility, because stuff keeps coming out. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, you know, normally, I mean, the logic is, you know, you want to be long this last week, right? I mean, that's historically, that's been a winning bet. But boy, I'll tell you what, there have been a few times when it hasn't paid, and when it hasn't, it's usually been pretty bad.
Are they ever going to fill in the blanks on this CPI?
I don't know. We'll find out next month. But like I said, I didn't even do a column on it because
it's one number.
Not only that, can you even believe any of, you know, there were There were a few people that came out. I saw some pundits that came out and said, you know what, there's enough missing here that I don't even actually believe the headline.
Why do you suppose they got rid of the percentage in the basket? They got rid of that column, too.
That makes absolutely no sense at all. Why would you do that? I'm just saying there's no logic behind what I saw there, okay? Like, none.
I know I'm not supposed to say this, but didn't that what the Reich did? They stopped giving people numbers?
Well, hey, listen, and by the way, you're going to have fusion energy, it's going to be too cheap to meter, and it will be next year.
By the way, my stock's up, and maybe we front-ran it, maybe we didn't. You know, this is crazy world. Anyway, S&P futures up 450, back tomorrow. Nice job, Ricky. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.